With the latest in agriculture news from across the state and the country, it's Farm City News Day. And here's your host, Sabrina Hill.
Good morning. Thanks for turning on the radio this Monday morning for your agriculture news. Today is Monday, July 24th. Coming up in today's show, we get to know the new executive director of the Sacramento County Farm Bureau. We'll have a full interview with him coming up later on in the show, but we start off this morning with Brian German.
The American Farm Bureau Federation is holding a public event in Visalia next month, and they're looking for feedback from California dairy farmers. The AFBF is proposing a new risk management tool called the Dairy Revenue Protection Program. Corinne Madison is a legislative analyst for the Federal Policy Division at the California Farm Bureau Federation. She noted the details about the upcoming event.
So the meeting is going to be held on Wednesday, August 2nd at the Tulare County Farm Bureau office, which is in Visalia, and it's going to be from 3 to 5 p.m.
Farmers who may be unable to attend the meeting in person are still encouraged to express their interest, as there may be an alternative method to get involved.
So if we have a lot of interest coming from areas that are far away from Visalia, we might offer a webinar or a follow-up call for other people to get more information.
I'm Brian German for AgNet West.
As crews continue to fight the Detweiler fire in Mariposa County, thousands in the area remain evacuated from their homes. More than 3,000 fire personnel are fighting the blaze, which is larger in size than the city of Seattle. Dozens of homes and other structures are destroyed. The area is home to many livestock ranchers and homeowners with horses and other large animals. As fire devastates the land, among the problems that it creates is where to house those animals that are now without homes or are threatened by the fire. There are a few resources available. Large animals are being housed at the Coarse Gold Rodeo Grounds, which you can contact by calling 559-994-2794. You can also contact the Horsemen Association for information on assistance with housing horses. That number is 209-354-9437. Elsewhere in the nation, the weekly U.S. Drought Monitor shows drought conditions in the upper Midwest and plains are expanding again. The weekly report says an upper-level ridge of high pressure in the western U.S. inhibited precipitation and kept temperatures warmer than normal across much of the West over the last week. The prolonged and intensifying drought ravaged crops and rangelands in the northern plains, while soils continue to dry out across the West, the plains, and into the Mid-Atlantic region. The California Senate and Assembly approved a bill to extend the cap-and-trade program through 2030. AB 398 passed by a two-thirds vote. Ag Council and other agricultural groups, in addition to many business and industry organizations, supported passage of AB 398 in the California State Legislature and worked to help secure the two-thirds vote in each of the legislative chambers. Simply put, the cap-and-trade program is the most cost-effective way to meet the ambitious greenhouse gas emissions reduction requirements that are already in place under California law that was approved in 2016. Without the market-based compliance system, cap-and-trade, the Air Resources Board has the ability under current statute to move forward with extreme mandates to achieve emissions targets that will cost Californians far more. Cap and trade is the least expensive approach to reduce carbon emissions and is 3 to 5 times cheaper than alternative methods. Ag Council supports an extension of cap and trade for several reasons. They say AB 398 provides critical cost containment mechanisms and certainty for the members in the cap and trade program by extending it through 2030. Without an extension of the cap-and-trade program, ARB currently has the statute authority to implement extreme command and control measures to regulate greenhouse gases. And Ag Council says that given that ARB can take severe regulatory measures under existing law, AB 398 is needed to ensure cap-and-trade is in place through 2030 as the market-based mechanism to meet greenhouse gas emissions reduction requirements. As more farmers are incorporating cover crops into their operations, research and technology to develop new seed varieties and traits is developing as well. Rod Bain reports.
Innovation in the cover crop seed industry. When might it travel at a trajectory similar to what has taken place with plant breeding and seed genetics over several decades now? That is a question those in the seed industry or that are users of cover crops may be asking.
That technology in cover crops probably has not gotten there because of the size of the market.
Although Tracy Talley of the American Seed Trade Association says he already sees genetic tools and technologies for the cover crop seed industry becoming more available. For comparison, he recalls his days as a college student in the decade of the 1980s, where he says plant breeding education for the most part was based on 1970s textbooks.
Our plant breeding at that point in time to define something or pick something was all human-based. We were looking at through visual appearance, feel, perhaps a taste, and we were using maybe weighing for yields. That was really our science. Now as technology is advancing, we're able to now start using that to identify things, all the way from being able to identify and speed up the selection process, which would be traditional plant breeding, to editing the genes, editing them perhaps by inserting something, or just internally editing the gene itself.
With new technologies then allowing identification of specific seed traits to occur, not in terms of decades, but in months or years. For example,
we're able to now identify what area of the plant triggers the drought tolerance ability. Because a lot of times you'll develop a plant that has higher yield. When you get the higher yield, you lose your drought tolerance. So now we can go in and get the higher yield through normal plant breeding and then hopefully be able to find that area that turns on the drought tolerance and simply activate it.
Risa DeMacy of Grassland, Oregon says progress is indeed being made in the R&D side of seed development for cover crop varieties.
These aren't your grandpa's cover crops. Most people think cover crops, they think cereal rye or maybe some of the brassicas. You know, there's some exciting tools out there, some almost like Swiss Army knives that do so many things.
So for instance, some cover crop varieties that deepen their roots in the fall and then bring needed nutrients into the soil come springtime, as well as prevent soil erosion, and for some plants, offer livestock a forage source. DeMacy adds this approach offers specific resource solutions for an ag producer, no matter where they're located across the country.
I think we're entering an age of high precision cover cropping and understanding how we all work together in the cycle. There's all kinds of new species that we're playing with. We're trying to find those things that might have a very specific, highly targeted use.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is Farm City News Day by AgNet West. I am your host, Sabrina Hill. We will be back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Attention, California citrus growers, production managers, industry professionals. The 26th annual Citrus Expo in Fort Myers, Florida is proud to host U.S. Secretary of Agriculture, Sunny Perdue, on August 16th, the first day of the show. Make plans now to attend the 26th annual Citrus Expo on August 16th and 17th for an opportunity to mingle with Secretary Perdue on the trade show floor. The latest in citrus research and data will also be presented at over a dozen seminars. Don't wait. Pre-register now at citrusexpo.net.
Welcome back to Farm City News Day by AgNet West. Here's Taylor Hillman.
A new online source is taking the frustration out of staying informed on the latest Asian citrus psyllid and Huanglongbing research. The University of California Department of Agriculture and Natural Resources has created the Science for Citrus Health website that will provide readable summaries of highly technical research. UC Cooperative Extension citrus entomology specialist Beth Grafton Cardwell said in a press release, quote, "The future of California citrus depends on scientists finding a solution to this pest and disease before they destroy the industry. Our farmers want to stay on top of all those efforts to stop this threat. The problem, which is an issue that's only getting worse as more technical research has been developed, is that the information can be hard for a non-scientist to understand." UCANR also points out that the information is also only published on subscription-only avenues. Grafton Cardwell and Extension biotechnology specialist Peggy Lemeau are the creators of the site's info and will provide one-page summaries on developments and research. The website also splits up the research into sections, so, for example, growers can see all of the early detection techniques in one place. Other sections include solutions for established orchards and replants, and a section called New Psyllid that has research looking at the viruses in the psyllid itself, and possibly modifying one of those to block the transmission of the bacteria that causes HLB. Did you know that research has identified 5 different viruses that are found in psyllids? The website also has a feedback option that allows anyone to comment on the research summaries. The website is hosted through UCANR, and the easiest way to find it is to type Science for Citrus Health into your search engine. Again, that's Science for Citrus Health. I'm Taylor Hillman for AgNet West Radio Network.
The House Budget Committee has voted 22-14 along party lines to send a fiscal 2018 budget resolution to the full House floor for consideration. It's not clear how the measure will fare. The House budget plan would cut spending by $5.4 trillion over 10 years, including more than $4 trillion in cuts to mandatory spending like Medicaid, Medicare, and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, as well as other non-defense programs to balance the federal budget by 2027. The blueprint calls for a $10 billion cut in programs under control of the House Ag Committee. Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts is not pleased with the blueprint. He argues that agriculture has already given its fair share, if not more, to eliminate the nation's debt. McGovern says SNAP is getting a bad rap, and he's trying to battle the stereotypes that some of his colleagues may have in mind about folks who utilize the program.
I am a little concerned as we gather here. This is our 23rd hearing on SNAP, and I just read the Republican budget, where it's proposed that there is a proposal out there for a $10 billion cut in SNAP, $10 billion. You know, in the last farm bill, there were savings of $104 billion. $92 billion came from SNAP. I know it's become convenient for some to look at SNAP as an ATM machine to pay for other things, but SNAP is a vital, important program that millions of families rely on to put food on the table. And it's not a particularly generous benefit. The average benefit is about $1.40 per person per meal. You can't even buy a cup of coffee for that. That's why many SNAP recipients end up at food banks at the end of the month. And yes, we need to figure out ways to help get people to be secure and have a job, and we're all for work. But understand one thing, 67% of the people on this program are not expected to work or cannot work. They're children, they're senior citizens, there are people who are disabled. Of those who can work, a majority work. And so let's get that on the record. I'm tired of the perception that somehow everybody on SNAP is lazy or doesn't want to work. The fact is, the majority of them who are able to do work, the question is, why do they earn such low wages? Why does work pay so little in this country?
Congressman Jim McGovern of Massachusetts.
Well, in today's livestock news, we hear from Ethan Lane, Executive Director of the Public Lands Council, the National Cattlemen's Beef Association's Public Lands. NCBA's Ed Franks talks with him about efforts on Capitol Hill to modernize the Endangered Species Act.
Modernization of the Endangered Species Act has been an issue at the top of the priority list for many years on Capitol Hill. The difference this year is that we have a real path forward because of the Western Governor's Species Conservation Initiative undertaken a few years ago by Governor Matt Mead from Wyoming during his tenure in charge of the Western Governors Association. He led a multi-year initiative to really take a look at the Endangered Species Act, how it works, and how we can improve it to make sure that it works the way the American people already think that it works.
So what did this effort by Governor Mead and the Western Governors actually look like?
That effort brought stakeholders to the table for a series of meetings across the West. We met in Wyoming, in Idaho, in Colorado, in Hawaii. And in all those places, they kind of focused on different aspects of the Endangered Species Act. In those rooms, we had stakeholders from the different resource communities, counties, state governments, wildlife agencies at the state level, the Federal Fish and Wildlife Service, as well as environmental groups that really contribute to a lot of the litigation that we see derailing that process all too often.
Now, from a legislative or policy standpoint, what exactly needs to be done to bring the Endangered Species Act into the 21st century?
So after 40 years of the Endangered Species Act being law and seeing how that has played out, we need to take some steps now to make sure that the process of evaluating whether a species is requiring protection as either a threatened or endangered species or needs to be listed under the Endangered Species Act needs to be driven by science, needs to be driven by the best available information on the ground, not by litigation from outside environmental groups. So these steps that we're looking at to improve and modernize the Endangered Species Act are really focused on that process, making sure that the states where the real data and manpower exist to manage these species and the real expertise on these species resides. One of the problems we see with the Endangered Species Act is that all the resources going to the Fish and Wildlife Service are kind of directed and consumed by that listing process. That's because they have such an overwhelming backlog of listing petitions. Instead, what we'd like to see is a shift towards managing those species that really need the help and an effort to delist those species that have already recovered. The states are doing a fantastic job. They have plans in place to manage these species, and the species, by and large, have blown past their original recovery goals. So we need to delist those species, but then we need to look at the 1,000 or so species that are left on the list. We need to make sure those species aren't ready to be delisted. And if they are, we need to go ahead and do that work, move them off the list so that we can focus our resources on species that really need the help. So our efforts on Capitol Hill are going to be focused on those sort of pragmatic pieces of the Endangered Species Act and improving that to make it work better.
Again, that was Ethan Lane, Executive Director of the PLC and NCBA's Public Lands. I'm Randall Wiseman for AgNet West. AgriView with Evergreiner is next.
Let me see if I can put it in more realistic terms for you to understand. Say you make so much money a month. You work 12 months. You add up your total salary for the year. Not bad. But suppose you didn't get paid for 8 of those months. You have to make it on just 4 months' pay for the year. Now, that doesn't happen. Well, it did. That's the way 2017 will be for peach farmers in Georgia. They lost about 80% of their crop to that late winter freeze. If you put that into dollars and cents, it's about $300 million. You hear me? Now there's more. Losses in neighboring South Carolina were even higher. South Carolina growers lost over 80% of their crop. And the rest of the story? It's expected to be even costlier when blueberry farmers total up their losses in that same winter storm. See how lucky you are? That's AgriView for today. Everett Griner, AgNet West.
In today's interview segment, I am chatting with the new executive director of the Sacramento County Farm Bureau, Bill Bird. All right, Bill, you are in your first week or so of this position as executive director at the Sacramento County Farm Bureau. I would like you to have the opportunity to introduce yourself to farmers who are listening up and down the state. Tell us a little bit about where you came from and what you're hoping to do with Farm Bureau.
I'm very excited, number one. This is my seventh day on the job. I'm going to tell the farmers up and down the state something you already know, Sabrina, in that both of us at one time worked together at another station a very long time ago at a different kind of lifetime. But I come out of broadcasting. I earned my degree at Fresno State University. I earned my degree in journalism. From broadcasting, I transferred over to the state capitol in 1999, working for one Republican legislator after another. The most recent would have been Senator Bob Huff, who served as the Senate Republican leader. He represented the 29th Senate District, which covered portions of Los Angeles, Orange, and San Bernardino counties. President Trump, while it was wonderful that he was elected and very happy about it, sort of depressed Republican turnout in California. That, in turn, led to some losses on the state level. Republicans lost 5 seats in the state legislature, 4 in the Assembly and 1 in the Senate. That is why several tax hikes have been passed this year, because the Democrats now have a rock-solid 2/3 majority. When that many legislators lose their seats, it also means the personal staff that serves legislators also loses their job. And there are no guarantees in this type of work. It's at-will employment. You're there one day, you're gone the next. And although some efforts are made to help people settle into a different office, when you're talking about 50 Republicans that have been thrown out of work and a Democrat-controlled town like Sacramento, that's tough. So I have been looking here and there for different opportunities. The Department of Water Resources, for example, wanted to hire me to go to work as an information officer and sort of serve as a support voice for the Delta Tunnel project. But this opportunity with the Sacramento County Farm Bureau just came out of nowhere. It was a door that opened and just hit me in the face. And the more I heard about it, the more intrigued I became. I have, although I am not from a farming background, I have a tremendous love and a tremendous appreciation for agriculture. I'm one of those very crazy homeowners who didn't want to put a pool in a quarter-acre sized backyard. I instead built raised gardening beds. I bought every fruit tree known to mankind. I worked with Dave Wilson Nursery to identify the newest and the best fruit trees. I wouldn't plant one pear tree, I planted 3. So I had that experience, I had that appreciation, and I've always had it. I grew up with it in Modesto. Just that appreciation of fruit and vegetables and what is grown here. And the more I thought about this opportunity that I got to be the face for Sacramento County agriculture, how could you possibly say no to an opportunity like that? And I accepted, and it's been a learning experience. I am replacing a wonderful lady by the name of Charlotte Mitchell, who was here for 12 years. And she is very well known. She is very well respected. She's very well liked. And that's going to be tough. I don't think I will be able to replace her. I am the new Charlotte, but replacing her is quite a that's quite a different challenge.
So you pointed it out, and I'm just going to bring us back to it. But you and I are friends. We're buddies, and we knew each other way back. My first news radio job when we were both in Fresno at news radio. And I have enjoyed following you and your gardening adventures on Facebook. And I know that you have that love and appreciation for growing things and working the soil and seeing how things are growing. And I have seen some of your experiments as your tomatoes especially. So what does it, you mentioned it a little bit, but tell us a little bit more about what it means to you to now be getting to work for the farmers who are doing this all the time.
Well, you know, not only that, I would write about these things too. And I didn't have the heart to tell the board members at the Sacramento County Farm Bureau that what they want me to do is something that I've essentially been doing for free for the past 10 years in a blog called Sacramento Vegetable Gardening. And this is a blog that at one time was named the 10 best, was in the 10 best vegetable gardening blogs in all of America. I was right below Martha Stewart. Martha's a little bit more famous than I am. But it was my experience of finding these things. For instance, I'll give you an example. I searched high and low for an avocado tree that would survive freezing conditions. I could not find one. I kept on planting cold weather varieties that would die in the first freeze. And the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over again and expecting different results. So one day I started doing my research and I found out about this wonderful avocado variety in Butte County called the Duke. It is no longer grown commercially, but it happens to be a bulletproof type of avocado tree. In other words, it can not only withstand a freeze, it grows through a freeze. It laughs at freezing conditions. Its rootstock withstands a root rot disease that is primarily found in clay soils. Well, that was my soil in my backyard. So I actually went into Butte County and searched high and low for an old Duke avocado tree, and I found one in the Western Pacific Railroad Depot, which Oroville decided to keep for some reason as a historical area of interest. That's where I found the tree. That's where I documented that it was a true Duke avocado, took clippings from that tree, and actually grafted my own Duke, the first one that has been grown from a cutting in I don't know how long. That tree has been sitting in downtown Oroville for so long that everybody's essentially forgotten about it. But those are the types of things that I would do and I would write about. You mentioned the heirloom tomatoes. Yes. Who wants one heirloom tomato plant when you can grow 40? And that was just always my love in life. If I was not working for a legislator, I was in my backyard and I was always documenting. Most of the time I was just documenting my screw ups or mistakes, but that's how you learn. You do things, you make the mistakes and you say, oops, I'll never do that again. So, and I grew up with that too, Sabrina. I did. I grew up in a neighborhood where there were fruit trees everywhere. And when I was a child, we were poor, it was tough. And those fruit trees that dotted that neighborhood were my lifeline to an after-school snack. I didn't have a packaged after-school snack. I climbed the Robe des Sergents prune plum in the neighbor's front yard. I knew where all the pear trees were. I knew where the peaches and the nectarines were. I knew when they would come into season. I knew that loquats were the first fruit to come into season, but they weren't going to be the last. And I located where these trees were, and they were everywhere. It's almost like that in all older communities in the valley. But that's really where the love of fresh fruit and vegetables started as a child, and it just stayed with me through the years. And not just loving what is grown, but studying it and learning the background, learning the history. You know, how did the Dancy Mandarin come about? It's the first mandarin that was planted in California. Well, how did we get it? Where did it come from? And I found out that people call it the Dancy Tangerine because the budwood was brought from Tangiers. And it actually is a mandarin, but people call it to this day the Dancy Tangerine.
So is your blog still active? And give us the web address again if it is.
It is Sacramento Vegetable Gardening. If you go Google that, it is still active. I will warn the folks that are listening that last year was a little tough. I went through a divorce. I was not blogging as much. Some of the readers noticed this, and they were making observations in the comments section that I no longer had this paradise in a backyard that I had created and were wondering what was going on. There are some dark posts. I will bring up one example, Henri the Peach, and it was right after my wife and I split up. But if you go back a few years, you will start to see much happier times. It's a lighthearted blog, and it just deals with growing everything under the sun because you can do that in California. We would make a hot salsa, and everything that went into that salsa, every single ingredient except for the salt, would come straight from the backyard because you could grow it. You could grow the onions. You could grow the garlic here. And so we would I would document this all the time. I was always very proud of the things that we grew and the things that we could store, because it's just, there's nothing better, Sabrina, nothing better than in the dead of winter, opening up a can of tomato sauce or whole tomatoes that you canned yourself. And it's got the smell of summer inside that jar. And it's the middle of winter, and it's just a wonderful experience. So Sacramento Vegetable Gardening is where you'll find it. I also dabbled in beehives. If we have anybody who has apiaries, and I'm sure I'm talking to a few of them, I went through the process of running from single solitary bees and wondering how I was ever going to keep a hive in the backyard. But once you have a beehive, you never want to go without one. It's just not the same. So it's a documentation of what I've done.
So let's look at the future. And I know that there's a 100-year celebration happening with the Sacramento County Farm Bureau. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's part of the Heritage Club, which is based here in Sacramento. It's actually based out of the California State Fair. They are the sanctioned body that holds the records and goes through the recognition process. And Sacramento County was recognized just this week as part, and is now part of that exclusive club. To get into the club, to get this kind of designation, you have to have a financial stake in California for at least one century. Now, Sacramento County Farm Bureau is one of the few farm bureaus that have reached that part of the exclusive club. And it's not just the farm bureaus, it's the farmers as well, the farming families. And what was really interesting about that event yesterday were the farming families that were there. And there were sixth and seventh generation farming families that had been in business and had a financial stake in California for more than 150 years. And these families still own these farms. They still work these farms. And you brought them up from the oldest to the very youngest. You had kids and you had men and women who were also very old, but they were, it was just a fascinating thing to see. And it's a really, it showcases the work that Sacramento County farmers have done through the decades. That it showcases what they have built, and it showcases the Farm Bureau and its mission. And the mission of the farm is not just to grow and provide food for all of California or all of America, which it does, but it's also to educate. It's also to let people know what happens on these farms, what is grown on these farms. It's educating children about where their school lunch comes from. Unfortunately, sometimes they have to be told that chocolate milk does not come from chocolate cows, which I believed at one time, by the way. So that's the really exciting part about it, is that this organization has been around for so long and contains so many different people and it is so diverse. Agriculture in Sacramento County is not what it once was. This is the home of state government now, but there is still a lot of agriculture taking place here, which includes the Delta and a lot of spots in southern Sacramento County that you don't really think about. But these big operations, these big ranches, these big farms, they're still here. And they've been going on and doing this good work for many years, more than 100 years for some of these farms. So that's what the exciting part is. You get to put names to their faces, and you realize that the family farm hasn't gone anywhere. It still exists. The real challenge now is educating people that the family farm has not gone anywhere. It's right here. It's still healthy. We're going to feed America the best way we can, but sometimes we do face some challenges, and that's what the Farm Bureau sometimes has to address.
All right, Bill, I think that that is a perfect place to wrap this up. And I'm just so excited that you and I will get to work together a little bit. I was thrilled to see your name in there when I saw who was hired for the position. So congratulations, and thank you so much for spending a few minutes with us today and talking to us about what your background is and who you are. I appreciate it.
I thank you, because there are going to be some growers, especially in some parts of the state, like Fresno and Tulare County, who are going to say, I know that name, I know that person. And they do, because I was there once, and I was a reporter in those markets. And so I was dealing with people from the Farm Bureau, people like Bill Allison, who sadly passed away not all that long ago, but Bill Allison will be a mentor for me. And I know some of the growers that are there, that are still there. Some of them I went to school with at Fresno State. So I just want to say that you're all in my heart. I have not forgotten you. And even though I am just representing a small slice of California agriculture in Sacramento County, it's a small slice that I am proudly going to promote and defend with all of my heart.
For more on any of the stories you've heard here this morning, visit our website at agnetwest.com. You can also find us on Twitter at agnetwest or myself at Sabrina W. Hill. This has been Farm City News Day by Agnet West, and I am your host, Sabrina Hill. Have a wonderful day.